Moonlight, filtering through the leafy boughs, descend, paint white the shadows, make silver the lines of darkness, bringing forth the comforting shades of the familiar dell. Moonlight, white light, filtering through the leafy boughs, stop in thy silent descent but for a moment, for the nightingale is pouring from her silver urn the dews of song. Patience Worth. Hey y'all, and welcome to Southern Fried Spooky, the podcast home of all things Southern Spooky, and this week, poetic?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm your hostess and Carolina girl, Heather.
I'm your host, co-host, and lord of Antony.
We'd like to invite you to our virtual library where you can lounge in comfort whilst reading a lovely book and relaxing, which means come find us on Facebook and leave us some comments.
Indeed.
And some 5-star reviews on your podcast platform of choice.
And don't forget Patreon, and you can email us if you got story ideas, which we're always looking for,
Yes, at this point we're starting to run out of our own, but
yes. I think we're going to have to start delving away from the South.
I know there are more Southern spooky stories.
This is our this is going to be our 83rd episode.
That is a lot.
Yes.
Which is probably about at least 70 plus all Southern.
Yep.
So, yes, tell us ideas. We'd love to hear some. I know about South Carolina pretty decently, but I need help outside of here.
Well, we did read about the servant girl Annihilator.
Oh, I know. We have got to do that one.
Yes.
I hope it's long. So this week, we'll be talking about a Texas author who, in the early 1900s, became one of the most celebrated writers of her time.
Mm-hmm.
She worked in collaboration with a scribe of sorts, and is credited with the composition of books, voluminous poetry, short stories, plays, and reams of sparkling conversation. Nearly 4 million words between 1913 and 1937. Her name was Patience Worth, and her scribe was Pearl Curran.
Now, keep in mind, a lot of people don't know this about me. I do enjoy poetry.
You do?
I do. I like...
I know you're a big Shakespeare fan.
Shakespeare, of course. T.S. Eliot.
Ooh.
And Blake. I love Blake stuff. But, yeah, I mean...
I love his vibe, dude.
Who, Blake?
Yeah.
No.
I am fond of poetry as well.
Yeah, I like Pablo Neruda.
Oh.
Which, I mean, his is a lot of love poetry. But still, I'm a poetry fan. And this one, you know, when we were recording it, you started reading it, and I was like, okay, who's the author?
It's some pretty stuff. Very lyrical. So Patience Worth was listed as one of the outstanding authors of 1918 by the Joint Committee of Literary Arts of New York.
Mm-hmm.
She was also cited by William Stanley Braithwaite in the 1918 edition of the Anthology of Magazine Verse and Yearbook of American Poetry by printing the complete text of 5 of her poems, along with leading other poets of the day, including William Rose Bennett, Amy Lowell, and Edgar Lee Masters. Now, frankly, even though I was an AP literature student, advanced, I have not heard of any of these, but then again, I have not delved into a whole lot of American poets.
Yeah.
I do like Edgar Allan Poe. He had some beautiful poetry.
Poe had some great poems.
To One in Paradise, my favorite.
Stories.
Oh, some of his stories were wonderful but awful, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, at this point, you're probably wondering why we're talking about a poetess.
I'm even wondering about this.
Well, hold on to your seatbelts for a moment. The Index of Magazine Verse for 1918 listed the titles of 88 poems by Patience Worth that appeared in magazines during this 12-month period, only 2 of which were considered by Braithwaite to be lacking in any distinction. The same index listed 10 poems by Amy Lowell and 5 by, Edna St. Vincent Millay. I have studied her. Now, Curran lived from 1883 to 1937, and Worth lived from 1649 to 1694. So what makes all this particularly interesting is that Patience Worth was quite dead at the time.
Wait, really?
Really.
Wow.
Curran was born Pearl Lenore Pollard in Mound City, Illinois, on February 15th, 1883. The family relocated to Texas before she was even a year old, so there you go, we're in Texas now. She started school when she was 6, and she was not what we might call today an engaged student. Her work was average at best. She had a short attention span and read very little during her formative years. She eventually dropped out before completing her high school freshman year, later stating that she'd had a nervous breakdown due to the strenuous academics. And as I recall, academics for women was not exactly the most rigorous back in the day. She admitted to having little imagination and few ambitions beyond music. She did later resume her education at St. Ignatius Catholic School. When she was 14, her family sent her to St. Louis, and she made one last effort at attending school, but was discouraged when placed in a lower grade based on her actual academic skills. However, as mentioned before, she did have an affinity for music. She trained in piano and voice and aspired to be a prima donna, you know, the leading lady of a stage. The family moved again to Palmer, Missouri. So Curran's musical talent blossomed, and she was sent to Kankakee, Illinois, I'm sorry, Illinois, for that pronunciation, for voice training before moving to Chicago for tuition from J.C. Cooper. She worked at the McKinley Music Company addressing envelopes.
Not D.B. Cooper.
No, that would be different.
Okay.
He probably paid better.
All right.
Addressing envelopes for $6 a week. Then the Thompson Music Company selling music. If anyone has ever seen, like, In the Good Old Summertime, which maybe you haven't because that's Turner Classic Movies, that is a remake of The Shop Around the Corner, which is also, was then remade as You've Got Mail.
You've Got Mail, yeah.
Uh-huh. Anyway, back in The Good Old Summertime, it was Judy Garland, and the way they sold music back then is they actually had musically inclined people to play and sing it for you.
They usually wheel out like a baby grand or like one of those.
They just had one out.
and had somebody out there doing it. And people were like, oh, I like that music. No, buy the sheet music, you know.
Right. Because this was kind of before, any kind of the media. Top 20 or whatever. Top 40 stuff. Anyway, so that's why a musically inclined person could sell music rather than just being a shop clerk. I hope you really wanted to hear all that. Sorry. From the age of 18 to 24, she worked assorted jobs in Chicago during the winter months. That sounds terrible. Winter in Chicago.
I've been in Illinois in Chicago, I've been in Arcola, Illinois during the winter. Ugh, I can only imagine Chicago. And now, keep in mind, I was only about 50 miles south of Chicago, but still, that was horrendous. It's all flat and all cold.
And very windy, I understand. Yes. Have you noticed that we don't like the chill very much? Oh, and during the summer months, she taught music at home in Missouri. Okay, so Pearl married John Howard Curran when she was 24, which kind of sounds like a slightly older age for getting married back in the day. He was 36 in 1907.
Okay, so a 12-year difference.
Not terrible. He was a widower with one child already. Though by no means wealthy, they lived a lifestyle which gave Pearl free time for movie-going or playing cards with her husband and neighbors.
In 1907?
Yeah.
Wow, that's like near the beginning of the advent of what they would call talkies.
Yeah. Wow. Early stuff. Pearl's mother also lived with them. That sounds cozy. The Currens had an average education for that time and owned few books. Neither of them had traveled extensively. And the first 7 years of their marriage was, uneventful. Nothing much worth reporting.
I mean,
so for the most part, these were just normal, average, fairly uninteresting people.
Yeah.
Now, what was also popular around this time was the advent of spiritualism.
Yep. I forget the sisters that kind of...
The Fox sisters.
Yeah.
People got real Ouija board crazy. They were doing all kinds of seances and things. And this is when science and... I guess superstition were kind of mixing and fighting together.
Yeah.
In July 1912, Pearl Curran and her friend, Emily Grant Hutchings, who actually was a writer, were visiting a neighbor who had just bought her first Ouija board. It's like the first person who bought a TV, I guess.
Yeah.
During that visit, there came what purported to be a message from a relative of Mrs. Hutchings.
I'm suddenly reminded of Back to the Future when he's like, yeah, we got two TVs. Who has two TVs?
Of course, now we have one in almost every room of the house.
You have one on your hand.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, seriously.
Emily then bought a Ouija board of her own and brought it to Mrs. Curran's house. She wanted to continue the communications. Pearl was initially somewhat indifferent and had to be coaxed to participate with the board. Of course, nowadays, most of us are like, don't play with Ouija boards.
Yeah. Anybody who's ever had any kind of real paranormal experience, as soon as somebody breaks out the Ouija board, they're like, nope, 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 nope.
I love the way they look. I love their style, but yeah, I mean, I don't like the idea of using a welcome mat
that's a Ouija board.
Yeah, but despite the cats playing on it, I don't think they've summoned anything. An entity or two floated through the Ouija board, and then on July 8th...
Her Ouija board.
Yes. On July 8th, 1913, the board seemed to be... the phrase was, possessed with unusual vigor. An elaborate message came through.
Get up and do the dishes?
Not that vigorous.
Okay, the elaborate message was...
Many moons ago I lived. Again I come. Patience Worth my name. Wait, I would speak with thee. If thou shalt live, then so shall I. I make my bread at thy hearth. Good friends, let us be merry. The time for work is past. Let the tabby drowse and blink her wisdom to the fire log.
Can you imagine how much it would take? Like, you know how, like, with Ouija boards, you're like, A, B, X. Like, to spell out that entire freaking poem, it's a...
It's not even really a poem. It was her introduction.
But what I'm saying is, like, all of that would have taken, like, 45 minutes. Okay, keep writing, keep writing.
Well, you know, this is, again, the days before TV. They may have had a radio in the house, so they had time. Mm-hmm. They're okay. When asked when she lived, the dates 1649 to 94 were given, and that her home was across the sea in England. She never named the town or village in which she lived. Casper Yost...
All ghosts transcontinental?
What's stopping them?
Okay.
I mean, unless they're kind of stuck in a haunt, I guess they could go wherever. Mm. I mean, she's not so much a ghost, really, as just a spirit. If that makes sense.
None at all, but please continue.
So, Casper Yost,
mm-hmm.
good name for a ghost story,
yep.
was a fairly close friend of the Currens and later wrote a book about the experience himself. He pieced together clues that... to him suggested that Patience Worth had lived in rural Dorsetshire, I may have butchered that, with her parents John and Anne. Curran had a mental picture of the place in which Patience Worth lived, indicating that Patience lived in green rolling country with gentle slopes, not farmed much, with houses here and there. 2 or 3 miles up this country on this road was a small village, a few houses. Curran visualized Patience leaving for America on a 3-masted schooner. Patience was described by Curran as probably about 30 years. Her hair was dark red, mahogany, her eyes brown, and large and deep. Her mouth firm and set, as though repressing strong feelings. Yep, that sounds British.
Yep.
Her hair had been disarranged by her cap and was in big, glossy, soft waves. Curran also saw Patience sitting on a horse holding a bundle tied in sailcloth and wearing a coarse cloth cape, brown-gray. That sounds very attractive.
You're right.
With a hood like a cowl, peaked. The face is in shadow. She's small, with coarse square-toed shoes and gray woolen stockings.
Now, was this dude some kind of seer? Like,
well, she explains that normally she is not.
Yeah.
But with Patience Worth, she would kind of, I don't know if she just had to get into a groove with it, but she could visualize everything Patience said to her. I mean, in vivid detail, which is something she wasn't accustomed to doing.
Alrighty then.
After a long voyage, the ship arrives at the jagged coast of America, where they could find no particular landing place for the ship. They launched several flat boats, and according to Curran, Patience was standing in the prow of her boat and became one of the first to reach the shore. Patience Worth stated later on that she was eventually killed by the natives. How rude. For 3 centuries, she said, she'd searched for an earthly mind to keep her, or to help her fulfill her burning literary ambition. She found it at last in Pearl.
I don't know many native tribes that would just outright kill people.
I don't know. I mean, I guess you would know more about that than I do.
I can't think of only but a handful that would just outright kill people, so she had to land in someplace very specific.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we know where that is.
Dancer wasn't like on Plymouth Rock or anything.
No. I don't know, maybe the natives had gotten an idea of what the newcomers were like. Like, nope, go back. News of the phenomenon traveled quickly through the Curran's middle-class neighborhood.
Do-do-do-do-do.
And they were deluged with requests to witness Pearl communing with Patience. And in no time, large groups of people were gathering regularly in the Curran's home. Curran claimed that she could anticipate what the Ouija board was going to spell, and by 1919, the pointer would just move aimlessly about the board. Curran described her pictorial visions, which accompanied Patience's words. She says, "I'm like a child with a magic picture book. Once I look upon it, all I have to do is watch its pages open before me and revel in their beauty and variety and novelty. When the poems come, there also appear before my eyes images each successive symbol as the words are given me. When the stories come, the scenes become panoramic, with the characters moving and acting their parts, even speaking in converse. The picture is not confined to the point narrated, but takes in everything else within the circle of vision at the time. If the people speak a foreign language, as in the sorry tale, I hear the talk, but over and above is the voice of Patience, either interpreting or giving me the part she wishes to use as story."
So split personality, got it.
Pearl Curran went on to describe her association with Patience Worth as one of the most beautiful that can be the privilege of a human being to experience.
Hmm.
Pearl and Patience wrote several novels. Could you imagine taking dictation on a Ouija board? As noted, she wasn't actually taking so much dictation as she was, just seeing the stories.
Yeah.
They wrote several novels, including Telka, The Sorry Tale, Hope Trueblood, The Pot Upon the Wheel, Samuel Wheaton, an Elizabethan Mask, as well as several short stories and poems. And the work started to attract national headlines, serious reviews, and even a movie deal.
And you probably heard a poem at the beginning.
Indeed, just to give you a touch of what her poetry was like, her prose was just as sparkling, I understand.
Yeah.
I mean, it may not, if you read it today, it might sound a little dated, because indeed, a lot of authors write for their time. Though with Patience, she had a lot of time to consider.
One would think. Well, I've been dead for 200 years. I think I've gotten pretty good at poetry.
Well, that, and apparently she wrote about times other than her own. Because, again, she'd sort of been floating around for a couple of centuries and had seen a lot.
Yeah.
One autumn evening in 1919, a crowd of prominent New Yorkers jammed the parlor to meet the writing prodigy named Patience Worth. She was considered a prolific charmer who was known for her quick wit. Patience dictated two original poems, one about Russia and the other about the Red Cross, in rapid succession, followed by a lyrical tribute to an editor friend. Poet Edgar Lee Masters was among the astonished guests.
I know that name.
There is no doubt she is producing remarkable literature, the author of Spoon River Anthology told a reporter, though how she does it I cannot say.
Vogue on poetry is widely accepted as the third worst in the universe. The second worst is that of the Asgoths of Crea. During a recitation by their poet master, Grunthos the Flatulent, of his poem Ode to a Small Lump of Green Putty I Found in My Armpit One Midsummer Morning, four of his audience died of internal hemorrhaging. And the president of the Midgalactic Arts Nobbling Council survived by gnawing one of his own legs off. The absolute worst poetry was written by Paul and Nancy Millstone Jennings of Sussex. Luckily, it was destroyed when the Earth was.
Stephen Broud, a professor of philosophy at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and past president of the American Parapsychological Association, who has written widely on paranormal phenomenon, stated, "What is extraordinary about this case is the fluidity, versatility, virtuosity, and literary quality of Patience's writings, which are unprecedented in the history of automatic writing by mediums." Of course, there were skeptics. They derided certain aspects of the supposed communication and found it curious that Patience was able to write a novel about the Victorian age, an era some 200 years after her own. In 1914, Curran traveled to Boston to be tested by the psychologist Morton Prince. Curran used the Ouija board at his home on two occasions, but refused to be put under hypnosis because she believed that it would destroy her contact with Patience. Morton told reporters, "Nothing of scientific importance occurred, and I consider the results inconsequential and of no scientific value."
You didn't read that right. Nothing of a scientific importance.
Thank you.
Yes. Most unorthodox.
Okay, you have to do all the stuffy old white men, though.
Yes. I call that my, what was the guy who ran all the railroads? J.P. Morgan.
Oh.
Most unorthodox. That's my J.P. Morgan voice.
Okay, good to know.
Yes.
We'll call that out occasionally.
Indeed.
In 1919, Charles E. Corey, professor of philosophy at Washington University in St. Louis, published a paper titled Patient's Worth in the Psychological Review. Corey believed Patient's Worth was a subconscious personality of Curran.
Okay. You know me.
I do. We've met.
I like reading medical journals for fun.
Because you're weird.
Okay. A published paper in a psychological review simply entitled Patient's Worth, the title is sus. Have you ever read the titles of some of those things?
Well, consider it. There might have been a subtitle, but this was just all that was suggested there.
Okay.
I mean, you can look it up and see if there's more to the title, but I do understand what you're saying. They
if you don't,
are wordy.
If you don't read stuff like that, it's not very riveting things.
Oh,
like,
no, no.
But I enjoy just the knowledge of, you know, learning things, so...
Still, the literature produced was considered to be of a high quality by literary-type people. For instance, the literary critic William Marion Reedy considered the story tale to be a new classic of world literature. How many of you have read that in high school? Scholars right. who examined Patience's work marveled at her deep knowledge of the plants, customs, clothing, and cuisine of several historical epochs, stretching back to the ancients, and at her ability to draw on this vast knowledge without hesitation. Again, the theory being that a ill-educated or uninspired housewife probably wouldn't know a lot of this.
Yeah.
In 1916, the psychical researcher James Hyslop, wrote that the whole case for Curran's mediumship was based on fraud.
A fraud, I tell you.
Hyslop, I'm not really sure how to pronounce this. It's H-Y-S-L-O-P.
I'd say Hyslop.
In the Journal for American Society for Psychical Research, yeah, long titles.
Yeah.
Claimed Curran had known people from the Ozarks who spoke a dialect reminiscent of Patience Worth, and Curran's husband had studied Chaucer and educated her on the subject.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's likely.
Right, okay, I'm telling you right now. Reading Chaucer,
you have to know German, I think.
It is hard to do.
Oh yeah, I can't read.
Writing as Chaucer would be even harder to do.
Yeah, and I think if you're a middle class, semi-educated person,
no way.
Most people don't delve into Chaucer unless they're into, like, you know, getting their literary PhD.
Yeah,
or something.
Like that stuff is what I would refer to as the railroad spike of writing. You can look at it and go, that is really cool, but just understanding it,
yeah. Yeah, it's pretty old stuff. Like, people think Shakespeare is Old English. You can at least read it.
Yeah.
Chaucer is, I think, technically Middle English, and it's looking at it, it looks a lot more German. It is definitely before a shift in the English language.
Do yourself a favor. If you ever want to hear anything Chaucer, I wouldn't recommend watching A Knight's Tale for that. He was amazing, but you don't really get to hear any of his writing or poetry or anything.
No, no.
Listen to somebody read it on YouTube or a podcast. The only way you're going to freaking understand it.
If at all.
Yes.
So, yes, her husband had tutored her on Chaucer, allegedly. According to Hyslop, the case of Patience Worth was of... would you like to read this part? A fraud and delusion for any person who wishes to treat it seriously.
Oh, yes.
Hyslop also accused Caspar Joest, remember him?
Yep.
And the publisher of his book...
Caspar the Friendly Joest!
And the publisher of his book, Henry Holt, of knowing about the fraud but covering it up to increase sales of the book. Joest wrote articles in The Mirror defending Curran against allegations of fraud, and in response, Hyslop wrote a letter to The Mirror which claimed he had been told of Curran's knowledge of Chaucer by a scientific man who had heard it from Mr. Curran himself.
Mudslinging circa 1938.
Oh, it absolutely was.
This is flamethrowing at its earliest.
In 1938, the ASPR Journal published an anonymous article which refuted all of Hyslop's accusations. Therefore, you know, I say no. Mm. According to the article, the Ozark dialogue did not resemble the language of Patience Worth, and the knowledge of Chaucer would not have given Curran the vocabulary to compose the Patience Worth literature.
Flay for the press and dwell with sothfastness. Suffice unto the thing, though it be small. For hard hath hate, and cleaning tickleness, praise hath envy, and well blent over all.
Okay. Meanwhile,
yeah.
Good friend Emily Hutchings, remember her?
One eternity later.
Pretty much. She had been kind of edged out of the group in all of the Patience and Pearl mania. She decided to co-author her own book. She was a little jealous. It was her idea to get the Ouija board in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
So she wrote her own book, allegedly, with Mark Twain.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
It jumped up a notch.
It did, didn't it?
Wow.
Also, who had been dead?
Yeah.
Twain's daughter, this is hilarious to me, Clara Clemens, soon filed a case with the Supreme Court. She had sole rights to her father's stories. Hutchings either had to admit that the book wasn't by Twain and was thus a fraud, or say that it was by Twain and...
Page turning!
And therefore property of his daughter. Jap Herron, the publisher,
yeah.
Halted production and existing copies were destroyed.
Oof. Can you imagine finding an actual copy?
That would be kind of neat, though, just to be like, okay, who's come up with this?
Right.
It was because, for one thing, Hutchings herself was already a writer, and of course, Mark Twain had this unmistakable voice.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I kind of wondered, does she attempt to write as him, or... I don't know. We
Mark
have no
Twain
idea.
Mark Twain was also known to be unbelievably racist.
That was the other thing. She was from the same place in Hannibal, Missouri, that he was from.
Yeah.
You say that about the earlier generations as if they were likely to be any other way.
That is also very true.
I mean, he wrote in using some pretty racist slurs, but his characters weren't terrible.
I mean, Huck Finn traveled with Jim for a long time, and they became very good friends.
Yeah, probably I think the most racist caricature would be Injun Joe.
Yeah.
Because he's only ever portrayed as, like, the terrible villain of their town. Anyway, moving
on. What was Wes Studi's character in Dances with Wolves?
Oh, I don't know in Dances with Wolves. I remember him from Last of the
Mohicans. Oh, Last of the Mohicans. Sorry, Last of the Mohicans. That character, whenever I read about Injun Joe, that's what I envision.
I'm not sure Wes Studi would be happy about that, but maybe.
No, I'm just saying. Like, that's... I'm not envisioning Wes Studi as this. I'm envisioning that character.
Gotcha.
That he's so almost militant.
Makwa, I think was his name? Yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I know exactly who you mean.
Yep.
God, he was so good in that.
Yep. And pretty.
Oh, yeah. Originally, getting back on topic...
I was about to say, my tendencies aside, let's go...
John Curran kept meticulous records of the Patienceworth sessions. The Patienceworth record was a transcription of the conversations with the Ouija board, which ran into 29 volumes.
Good lord.
And was mostly recorded by John. He did it in shorthand while other people were writing out the lengthy parts.
Yes.
He passed away in 1922, and the record of the Patienceworth sessions became episodic and fragmentary, with long gaps of unaccounted time. Now, Pearl was pregnant with her first child, which was born 6 months after her husband's death. Talk about timing.
Right.
And, oddly, they had previously adopted a child, thinking that Pearl was infertile. And this was all at Patience's instruction. They adopted a daughter, named her Patience, called Patty. And apparently, kind of creepily, Patienceworth claimed that... Child Patty was hers, her own little fleshy doll.
So this woman had some problems.
I would say so. So
I mean, if your husband tried to teach you Chaucer, you'd have some problems.
Maybe. So they had the natural daughter, the adopted daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, though I suppose she's probably grown up and married and moved on, John Curran had that previously existing daughter.
Yeah.
So Pearl now had a family of four to support by herself, because, of course, her mother also lived with her.
Indeed.
And her financial situation was bleak. Herman Baer, a devoted friend, sent money to Curran and assured her that he would continue to do so as long as she needed it. And he provided Curran with an income of $400 a month for a number of years.
Well, in 1922, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's like someone walking up and saying, I'm going to give you $5,000 a month.
Well, apparently she needed it. She did try to enter the lecture circuit to make some money of her own. A few months after this enterprise began, her mother, Mary Pollard, passed away. The sessions with Patience Worth still continued regularly at Curran's home. Ouija boards and seances were starting to become old-fashioned in the new age of flappers, jazz, and prohibition. Even as Curran submitted stories to the Saturday Evening Post, it also printed, say, a satirical piece by Dorothy Parker, whom I adore, lampooning Ouija boards.
I don't know this name, Dorothy Parker.
Oh, she has some great stuff. She is fantastic. She was one of the only women in the Algonquin table.
Oh,
the round table there.
Oh, and not to jump back a little bit.
Sure.
But $400 in 1922 would be $6,862.35 nowadays.
Wow.
Yes.
That's very specific.
Yep.
Oh,
$6,000, almost $7,000 a month.
He must have really been fond of her. I cannot remember it exactly, but Dorothy Parker has always gotten some wonderfully sarcastic pieces out there, and one of my favorite little short ditties by her was something to the effect of, I really don't like to drink much, I'll have one or two at the most, three I'm under the table, and four I'm under my host.
Okay, that's kind of awesome.
She was a little naughty and very saucy. But a section of the satire seemed to have Curran in mind, describing how a woman named Mrs. Both channels poems from a spirit. The book, Heart Throbs from the Hereafter, is being rushed to publication while the public is still in the right mood. The only hitch is the ghost is being difficult about the royalties.
The Mel Brooks of her time.
Basically, yeah, kind of.
That's awesome.
She's very funny.
Then again, I think Mel Brooks was... No, he wasn't. He was just about to be born.
Well, considering that he's like 97 now.
Yeah, so he's getting pretty close. He was, yeah.
Curran married two more times, but both marriages were short-lived. In 1926, she married Henry Rogers, a widower of her late music teacher. When she was younger, Curran knew him as Uncle Henry.
Oof, okay.
It was a marriage of convenience, and as he was 25 years older than Curran and ill, in 1930, she moved her daughters to California with Rogers, and there she ran into her first love, Bob Wyman, at a party, and they resumed their thwarted romance. Apparently, she had been sort of made to marry Curran in the first place.
Oh.
According to Shay, the elderly Dr. Rogers urged his wife to divorce him, giving her the freedom to marry her first love, an offer she had accepted by December 22, 1931, when she and Wyman were married.
What of the kids?
I don't know. In the summer of 1930, Curran left St. Louis for good and moved to California to live with an old friend, Alexander Bailey Dotsy Smith, in the Los Angeles area. Patience continued to communicate through Pearl until November 25th, 1937, when she gave what was her final communication. Pearl had apparently received a prior communication from Patience that she was going to die soon. Pearl told Dotsy Smith, "Oh, Dotsy, Patience has just shown me the end of the road, and you will have to carry on as best you can." And even though Pearl had not been in ill health, she developed pneumonia later in November and died on December 3rd, 1937.
Now, did the ghost actually say that she was going to die, or is this sort of like the self-fulfilling prophecy thing?
Don't know. But, I mean, that's how she told people about it. Her children had lost not just one, but two mothers, it seems.
And not to mention, like, five dads.
"We always felt Patience was within our call and reach when Mother was here," Patty said in an interview. "Now she is gone, just as certainly as Mother is gone." While Eileen, the older daughter,
"Come on, Eileen,"
went on to marry, Patty floundered with substance abuse and bad relationships, and in 1943, she died of an accidental drug overdose at 27 years old. Mm-hmm. Now, we're bouncing around in the timeline a little bit.
Apparently, we are.
In 1916, Caspar Yost published Patience Worth, A Psychic Mystery. In the book, he considered the case of Patience Worth to be inexplicable by any naturalistic theory. He was open to spiritual hypothesis. A thorough investigation of the case was conducted by the psychic researcher Walter Franklin Prince, who I have mentioned already.
Yes.
His book was The Case of Patience Worth, which was a voluminous report of 509 pages, covering the case from 1913 to 1927. It was published by the Boston Society for Psychical, which is a weird word to me, research. It provided a biographical sketch of Pearl Curran, eyewitness reports, opinions, and reviews, poetry of patients and Pearl.
Yeah.
And much other information related to the case. Prince concluded his investigation by stating, "Either our concept of what we call the subconscious must be radically altered so as to include potencies of which we hitherto have had no knowledge, or else some cause operating through but not originating in the subconscious of Mrs. Curran must be acknowledged."
Well, okay.
The parapsychologist Stephen E. Broud has examined the case of Patience Worth and concluded that Pearl Curran was probably a highly gifted child whose talent for writing was smothered by her mother, who wanted to force Pearl into a singing career. In the alter ego of Patience Worth, her subconscious could revive that talent. Broud has written, "There is little reason to think that the evidence supports the hypothesis of survival. Although Patience offered various clues regarding her origin and identity, subsequent investigation revealed nothing to indicate that a Patience Worth ever existed."
That's what I was about to ask. Is there any kind of proof that this woman was real?
Casper Yost tried to go and identify or find records, but she was always a little vague. Actual documentation has not been found. Broud also considered the possibility of a super psi, the view that Curran had subconsciously utilized a form of extrasensory perception to gather information. To me, it seems like they're really stretching to explain all this.
Or she had a split personality.
Well, it's possible, but can you develop a split personality that knows more than you do?
Absolutely.
Oh, no. Okay.
There are reported cases. Now, keep in mind, having DID is very few and far between.
Yeah.
Like, people are like, "Oh, I have a different personality." You really wouldn't know it. Not to begin with, anyway. And there is a guy who has a split personality. One of his personalities is a diabetic. And it is, whenever the personality is there, he has diabetes.
That's weird.
Yes.
You'd think of it as a merely psychological thing, but if the body goes along with it, how strange.
Yep.
Well, y'all, we've come to the end of another flowery and poetic and fairly long for us episode. There is plenty of other documentation out there if you'd like to find out more. And there's even a website that actually, just look up Patience Worth, that has several, lots and lots of her poems. Probably not all 88, but a lot.
Yeah.
That's where I found the one that we opened with. And it is really pretty stuff. It's sort of like Shakespeare. Whether or not you believe Patience Worth wrote it through Pearl, it's pretty stuff. So let us know what you think. Leave us some likes and 5-star reviews. Join Patreon.
Indeed.
Join us next week for another one of these things that we do at this point
in
time.
It's going to be Valentine, isn't it?
We have one more before that.
Okay.
We're going to be doing an extra one recording ahead because we're going to Disney for a week.
Yep.
And we don't want to have to work during this.
Indeed. But, yeah.
Yeah. So, at this point, we don't know what the next topic will be, but, you know, it's exciting. You'll find out when we do.
Indeed.
I'm your Carolina girl, Heather, and Lord, I need some water.
I am your Florida man, Tony, and I'm going to close this with two of my favorite poems.
Oh. And together we are
Southern Fried Spooky.
Until next week, bye y'all.
To see a world in a grain of sand, and heaven in a wild flower, to hold eternity in the palm of your hand, and infinity in an hour. And one of my favorites, I curse my stars in bitter grief and woe, that made my love so high, and me so low.
Nice.